We are going to do a survey of Islamic history with particular interest in the relationship between Muslims and Jews. That's today. The kind of, you know, the long, quick move through getting the kind of general direction of history. Day two is God, the Quran, and Islamic law, although we'll be looking at the Quran today as well. And then the third day is about Islam in practice and the ummah, or the, you know, the kind of full community of Muslims in the world. And then the fourth day is contemporary Islam and Jewish-Muslim relations, also considering issues of interfaith programming between Muslims and Jews. And that sort of, that's good because that corresponds with the dialogue group meeting as well. And today corresponds with the history of Jewish-Muslim relations. So, so today would be questions that you might have about any particular aspect of the history between Jews and Muslims, between Muhammad and the Jews, so-called golden age, issues of, you know, kind of deconstructing any images or notions or narratives in that regard. So I'll give you just a couple of minutes, and then we'll just begin. And I'm going to, I don't work with notes, but I work with texts. So in some cases, we'll be looking at some texts. I will try to give a kind of a chronological, linear view, but my mind doesn't work linearly. It's very associative. So, this is really much better than just trying to go with notes. I have lots and lots of notes in this computer. If we want to get into some detailed issues that I feel like I should kind of check up on, mm-hmm. I have material from lots of lectures and courses that I've taught. So, you have any ideas, issues, questions? No?
I think we studied some in our history class. We used the book Cultures of the Jews that describes, and I was very interested in, I think that's my rabbinic mind as well, concerning text. Mm-hmm. In the book, Biali, he gave some examples of midrash elements that were used in Quran.
Which, was this my article, or was it somebody else's article?
I think, I'm not sure, to be honest.
It might have been my article, because I did that section.
Yeah?
Okay. In that collection.
Yeah.
So, something about that relationship.
Okay. Because what I know about the Quran is that it presumed that people knew Torah and some of the Christian sources, and it built upon it. It took parts, but also continued from that starting point. But that's, I think, more for day four, how Muslims today look back at their own source material.
Yeah.
And as far as you can talk about Muslims or Islam in general.
Anything? It's okay not to have something to
I remember from last time the clear separation you made between the your own story and the scientific investigations and what you know as a historian and what you know as the one who tells your own story. Did the Exodus of Egypt happen or didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's for the historian. When I sit at the Seder table, you know, there's no doubt about it. Or Shavuot is where is Sinai. So that inference was very, very helpful, I found.
Right. So, and we'll be doing that. So that is a part of the methodology of this course, is we'll be looking at Islam both as insider and as skeptic. Right. So we'll look at it kind of using both methods. What do Muslims' range of thought, range of feelings about their own history and tradition, and what does Islam say about itself, which of course is not accurate from a critical perspective, and we can say the same thing about Jews, Judaism, Christianity too, And then the other issue is how does the cold, cruel academic view examine the same phenomena? And this is the methodology that we generally employ, or I generally employ in Jewish studies too, when I teach rabbinical students at HUC. We kind of do both insider and outsider, or believer and skeptic perspective, and we need to do that with Islam too. But it's important to do that in my view because, believers usually only have the insider perspective, and people who are not members of the religious tradition almost inevitably have the outsider or skeptical perspective, and so you immediately have a clash and tension when Jews are speaking to non-Jews, or when Muslims are speaking to non-Muslims.
Or when rabbis are talking to their congregation from the pulpits.
Yeah, true. Right.
Don't decide to preach.
Right.
Overly decide
to. Right. So that's important to keep in mind always.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about pre-Islamic Arabia for a moment and get a sense of it. I did a certain amount of this within the book too, but some of this will be repetition, and hopefully there'll be some other data that was not included in the book, and I'll be able to. And this is not like an open lecture, this is a discussion, so you can ask questions or stop me or interrupt and challenge anything. Okay. So the Arabian Peninsula was one of the few parts of the Middle East that was never under the control of any of the empires. Not the Egyptians, not the Assyrians or the Persians or the Babylonians or the Greeks or the Romans. So, but they had influence, but they never actually controlled it politically. So it always remained an open territory. And it always had a certain aspect of it that was like Hefkerut, it was a kind of chaotic area, vis-a-vis the notion of law and universal systems. There was never any imposed universal system. There are, of course, cultural systems that become, in their own way, a kind of universal sense of expectations among communities of people, but there was no legal tradition, for example, in Arabia, as there was in Israel, or as there was in the, especially when there are empires, because the Code of Hammurabi, was a Babylonian code, and there were other codes and laws that were imposed because you needed to have some kind of seder in an empire, and you needed to have some kind of rules of expectations and behaviors and taxation, mobilization for military purposes and for major construction works, and right. And so there are systems that are supposed to apply. They don't apply to people equally, but they do apply. And Arabia never had that. So who lived there? The Arabs, of course, because this was Arabia. But the Arabs were not living in isolation. It was, because it was never under the control of empires, it had a tendency to attract misfits. So the kind of people that would go to Arabia would be, Arabia is not a pleasant place, in terms of climate, in terms of economy. So it's not an attractive place for people to come. If you grow up there, you're used to it. So there's an indigenous population that remained there and was suited and adequately for the environment. And those were basically two social economic categories of people. There were pastoral nomads, the kind of Bedouin types, and then there were sedentary agriculturalists who lived in the oasis. There are some debate about what was the majority population. Some people believe that the agriculturalists were actually a greater population than the nomads because the agricultural areas were better able to support a more dense population, and the nomads were spread so thinly that there really weren't so many of them. But whether that's true or not, the nomads were the dominant character. And then not only the romantic orientalist perspective, which sees the noble nomad out there herding camels as this kind of romantic ideal, but also because they were the more powerful. They, nomads by their very social economic position, are more powerful than sedentary peoples. And they are in constant relationship with sedentary peoples. So there is relations between the nomadic Arabs and the settled Arabs. And that relationship is always one of tension. And here here's how it works out. The nomads are mobile, and their source of income is herding flocks, and which provides a certain amount of food for them, but not entirely. You can't live on meat and milk alone. So you need vegetables. First of all, you need to graze your crops. Graze your animals. And you can do that reasonably well by moving in different areas at different times of year. But in the final analysis, there are times of year where you can't pasture anymore. There just isn't anything more. So what do? You have to purchase produce from agriculture. And that is controlled by the agricultural communities. The agricultural communities don't really need the nomads, but the nomads really need the agriculturalists. So that puts the nomads at a disadvantage, right? But they create the need for the agriculturalists to need the nomads by raiding. They simply raid them. And the nomads are more powerful than the agriculturalists because they can always retreat into the desert, whereas agriculturalists really are unable to do that. I just want you to know, I have this thing about doing telephone and doing stuff like that. So you may have a reason for this, but I just want you to know, because I've had some very unpleasant experiences with my medical students in L.A., so I get very distracted. It's very hard for me to concentrate.
I'm sorry. I'm actually just sending a text to say I'm in class. I can't talk.
Yeah, okay.
I apologize.
It's okay. I just I need you to know that I will get thrown off when that happens.
Sorry.
So the way that the nomads guarantee, this is actually ends up being important for later on. The way that the nomads guarantee that they will have trading relationships with the agriculturalists is to offer protection against other nomads. It's a standard mafia procedure. I'm going to protect you against us, basically. And so you must trade with us for reasonable terms, and we will protect you from everybody else, and we won't raid you. So there's always this kind of tension. And that's, by the way, reflected in the Tanakh many times. The first reference of the tension between agriculturalists and nomads?
Canaan.
Yeah, exactly. That's like the first story, right?
Yeah.
And that is a reflection of that kind of tension. Jacob and Esau, Isaac and Ishmael, these are all kind of...
Sure it wasn't the snake and Eve?
Isn't there also a tradition of fortified oases or anything like that? Where
oh, sure.
And that's
yeah. But oases, in the oases in Arabia, the different communities lived in defensible fortresses.
Mm-hmm.
But they wasn't good enough. I'm going to kind of shift gears for a moment. Whenever you have a sedentary population that develops a civilization, mm-hmm. and you can develop what we call civilization only when you're not hunting and gathering. You know, when you're traveling all the time, you're spending all of the time just surviving.
Right.
So whenever people began settling and developing what we call civilization, they need to protect themselves from the nomads.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Because as soon as you begin developing, this is a very highly sophisticated theory of religious of migratory structures, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's called the technical term for this is the fat and sloppy versus the lean and mean peoples.
Mm-hmm.
So when you develop a civilization, you get fat and sloppy. You have a division of labor, you have excess amount of food, you can spend your time thinking about things, developing ideas, sitting down and conversing with one another, and you're not out running all the time to survive, and you get literally physically weaker.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to, make up for that mm-hmm. deficit,
mm-hmm.
and so you can do that by building walls, and you can do that by hiring mercenaries, but you're certainly not going to go out and fight yourself if you can avoid it, right? So those tactics create other problems, especially the mercenary issue, because what you're doing is you're going out and you're kidnapping or taking or encouraging other people to fight for you. And then after a while, they turn around and they say, why should we be fighting for you with these patent-slapping people? I want this. So then they take over. Mm-hmm. Or the walls don't hold up because the people living out on the steppe who are struggling to survive and they're really tough, lean and mean, and they see these happy, fat, mm-hmm. plump and happy people who are full, mm-hmm. and they want it for themselves. So they go down and they destroy the empire or the settlers or the settled people. It may not be an empire yet. And then they partake of all the good life and then they become kind of plump. And then the next group of people off the step look down at the happy people down below and they do the same thing. So, and then people move because they get pushed out. The survivors move. Mm-hmm. And they migrate to other areas. This was probably the reason for the Abrahamic migration of the Fertile Crescent also. Because the steppe in those days was the Iranian plateau, and people in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley were always needing to protect themselves from those peoples in the Iranian plateau, and then behind them, the Asian peoples, Turkic and Mongol mm-hmm. peoples that lived in more Central Asia, and they kept coming and moving into Mesopotamia. And then those peoples, when they were pushed, ended up moving westward because mm-hmm. there was no place to go eastward. Mm-hmm. So they went westward and north mm-hmm. and they went around that crescent and then down into Eretz Israel. And they also went up into Europe and across the Bosporus in that area as well. That seems to be a pattern. Mm-hmm. And you see that with numbers of different people. So. Anyway, to go back to Arabia, you have this tension between mm-hmm. these two communities. The other source of income for the nomads was transport. And they would, and in that, they had something to contribute to the agriculturalists, because agriculturalists did need products, and they weren't traveling. Mm-hmm. They needed to be on site to control their resources and to farm. And so the nomads would trade in goods. So the nomads in Arabia were actually responsible in partnership with an agricultural community in the south, in what is today Yemen, mm-hmm. in producing a commodity that was very necessary for ancient Middle Eastern culture. And they had a monopoly on the product. The product was necessary. So I'm going to ask you what you think that product might be. I just wonder if you know. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily know, but
salt.
You
know.
You mentioned in the book, and I can't remember.
Yeah. it is an absolute requirement, universal requirement in ancient Near Eastern cultures, up through the Greco-Roman period, and that's incense.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Sometimes they call it the spice trade, but it's not spices for food. Mm-hmm. It's burning spices, and that was necessary because.
Worship,
yeah. Because mm-hmm. if you're burning animals, it's not like barbecue.
Yes.
Yeah.
So to speak.
So think about this. Think about the Michoach part. Why? What's Michoach mean? It doesn't mean pleasing. We translate in English as the pleasing odor. It really is a calming odor. It's minucha, lanuach. Nah. So, in the ancient world,
that's the hashish.
Hmm? Hashish.
That's the hashish.
No, it's not the same root, but yeah, maybe. Yeah. So, in the ancient world, before there was a notion of omnipotent, universal, monotheistic God, the gods that controlled the universe were. Needed to be fed, and there was a. It turns out, it seems that there was a symbiotic relationship between humans and gods. Right? Humans fed the gods, and the gods took care of the humans. And so, prayer and worship was basically asking favors of the gods and paying them for it.
So
through sacrifice, offerings. And the re'ach mi'choach is to keep the gods calm down so they don't get upset and punish you. All punishment is in this world. There's no olam haba, right? So if you are good to your god, you do what the god says, they will make sure your crops are fertile, your animals are fertile, your women are fertile, all the things that are necessary in a patriarchal society to survive.
The weather is nice, you get rain.
Right. And you know, parenthetically, and this we may deal with a little bit later, but the all the tribal communities, the religious communities, first of all, religion and tribe are equal. Mm-hmm. Right? So tribes not only have to placate or feed the powers that run fertility and weather, but they also have tribal gods. So every tribe has its own personal god. So the Moabites had a god named Chemosh, the Philistines had a god named Dagon, the Ammonites had a god named Milcom. They all had personal names, because when you give the offering, you have to make sure that it goes to the right place. So if you don't have the address, it just goes up in the air. So you offer, you make the offering in the name of Milcom. And the Israelites had their own god in the name of whatever, however you pronounce that name. And that was before this transition to monotheism. So Israelites, Moabites, Canaanites, Philistines, they all were doing the same business. And which is very interesting, because we see these vestiges. Why do we need to calm down God? We don't need to. God doesn't need our offering, right? God says we don't need an offering. In Hosea and you know these, but we inherited this ancient system and we kind of moved it to a different location, to a different place. But that's the way it worked.
To which people does the moral belong?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But some gods were Baal. Was a Lebanese god, but also the god of weather. So,
wasn't Baal also
it's very confusing because a lot of the gods' names were Baal something, right? So, yeah, but there was a Lebanese in the Lebanon god called Baal who was connected with the weather. It was a very powerful god. And he apparently, so sometimes gods do double duty. And things change too, because as times change, gods, their names change, because for a number of different reasons. But we'll get to that later. I don't even know if that's necessary. But in any case, that's the system. So the Arabs living in South Arabia produced incense, because South Arabia was an area that got the monsoon rains before they went over to India. So South Arabia gets a regular rainfall during a certain part of the year. And if that rainfall can be captured and contained in with dams and aqueducts and waterworks, then they can grow crops throughout the year, and they produce these incense-growing trees, and the incense is from the sap. So the Arabs in the south, do you know what the Romans called South Arabia? You may have heard this before. Arabia Felix. Happy Arabia. And then the Arab nomads would transport the goods on camel through the desert up to Gaza, which was the closest port in the east, and up to Basra and Kuwait, which is the closest port on the Euphrates to the east. Right? Gaza to the west, I guess, northwest. And so that was very important. And Isaiah, by the way, refers to this trade in a famous to me passage where Isaiah says that, or God says that the time will come when the trading of gold and incense will be enhanced and everything will be lovely, and the peoples who are associated with that trade are and this is already in Isaiah, or way back at the end of the book, right? All the names that are associated there are the names of the children of Ishmael. So it shows that the Ishmaelites were indeed ethnic Arabs. Right? And there are a number of other, there's a lot of other evidence to suggest that, although the term Arab wasn't used, the children of Ishmael and Hagar, really, and Keturah, really were living in Arabia.
Was there a connection between the Nabataeans and the Arabs and the Peninsula?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, the Nabataeans were a group of... here's another thing that occurred regularly is that the Arabs in the Peninsula, when times were bad, mm-hmm. would move up into the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley area and sell themselves as slaves to just survive. So there was constant movement back and forth. And the Nabataeans were Aramaic-speaking Arabs who had moved north and mm-hmm. settled in that area. And but if you think about it for a moment, you know, the Arabian Peninsula moves up further north than Jerusalem. Because mm-hmm. it goes all the way up to into Syria. Yeah, you can see it, right? So you can just see the color right there.
Yeah.
So the Syrian desert is, by, you know, climatically, is part of the Arabian Peninsula. And so Arabs would, yeah, this is great. So this is, by the way, this is Midian. Mm-hmm. And maybe here too. So there are different, see, this is like the traditional Jewish view. But it's quite possible that, I mean, some people suggest that they actually were on this side of the peninsula for a while, or of the Red Sea, of the Gulf of Aqaba. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But anyway, Midian is really right here. And, yeah, and Amman, these, and Edom, they were Arabs. Edom, yeah. mm-hmm. That was Arab, for sure. Moab and Ammon were, at least Moab, you know, was a dialect of Hebrew, right? Because you could understand Moabite if you were in Israel. And if you look at, there are some inscriptions in Moabite that make sense in Hebrew, basically.
So that makes the root story. So why would the Moabites be stopped from entering the people?
Because they were essentially Canaanites. They had the same problem as all the Canaanites had, from the viewpoint of Israel. And that is that, well, at least I subscribe to the view that the Israelites are really Canaanites. That the Israelites didn't come from Egypt, and they didn't come from Haran, and they didn't come from Ur. Mm-hmm. But the Israelites were an indigenous community of people who developed a notion of monotheism, and they wanted to. They didn't want. They were always threatened with reassimilating into the local population because they were the local population. Mm. And so they created myths of origin that posited that they were from somewhere else and they shouldn't be connected to the local population. Let me just finish a little bit on this, and I'll tell you why. Because I think this way. Because even like the great, the divine command to destroy the Canaanites, which is such a ubiquitous story in Deuteronomy, and it's played out in history, in a kind of meta-history in Joshua and Judges, mm-hmm. it never happened. And in later books, like in Kings, that are really historically accurate, we know that they were, we have this terrible problem of the Israelites constantly wanting to backslide into Canaanite culture. Mm-hmm. And they never gave up the polytheistic practices. Mm-hmm. And they spoke the same language. And it's all the same language. It wasn't like if they came from Egypt or if they came from Haran. They spoke Aramaic. They didn't even speak mm-hmm. Hebrew there. Mm-hmm. And that was a different enough language in those days mm-hmm. that when Hezekiah is besieged, and the propagandists are yelling at the Israelites and saying, "Let us in, because if you don't, we will kill all of your men, women, and children." And they were saying it in Hebrew because they had translators. Hezekiah's administrator said, "Oh, you know, if you want to negotiate with us, negotiate in Aramaic, because we have translators. We didn't want them to speak Hebrew because they didn't want the people to get terrified by them. So they were trying to say, just talk to us in Aramaic, but not to us in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. We understand Aramaic." Mm-hmm. But that was the whole point. So it was a different culture. It was a different language.
So when was the convergence of Hebrew and Aramaic? Or was there...
It converged later in Talmud.
Right.
But Aramaic seems to have originated around Damascus. an area from some kind of proto-Northwest Semitic language. So Semitic languages are divided into different subcategories.
Mm-hmm.
And there is what they call Northwest Semitic,
mm-hmm.
which includes Aramaic and Hebrew, Canaanite languages, Phoenician. These are all Israelites mm-hmm. could understand Phoenician too. Ugaritic. These are all Western languages mm-hmm. in the north. In the east, Akkadian, Babylonian are substantially different language.
Mm-hmm.
And the south has Arabian, Arabic and South Arabian and other languages.
We studied this at one point, the called Joshua, when they came back, and they gathered together in Shechem, which was never occupied. And the other places there, it seems, from Joshua, those who came from Egypt came back to be with their tribes that never went to Egypt, but
yeah.
they were still there.
Yeah.
So
right.
it was people affinity.
Right.
Immediately. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So it suggests also that there was that
yes.
they were all.
Yeah, they were all Northwest Semitic tribes. Right. Some of them went to the exodus down to Egypt. Others
yeah.
stayed behind.
Yeah.
But it's all joined together again. Yeah.
So what do we tell our children?
Stand
you know,
what you should have learned when you were a child. Now this is the difference I just made between the scientific and the
yeah.
your own story.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You tell them that the modern Israelites, the modern Israelis who want to be Canaanites, you know, they have a long tradition behind them.
We were
bring their
from
children.
The beginning.
Yes.
Right.
We were the redemptors.
So, okay, so let's go back to Arabia. So in Arabia, we have these various tribes, and Arabia includes directly east of Jerusalem, right? So, and the tribal, here's another, before we get really into Arabia, the genealogies in Genesis are an attempt to place the Israelite community in relation to other communities in the region. And they recognize, just as I recognize as a gringo foreigner here in Holland, that the Dutch is very similar to English, but it's not the same language. And if I move further east to Germany, I find that it's less familiar to me. And if I go on further north into the Scandinavian countries, it might even be less familiar or maybe more familiar, I suppose, depending on where I go. So you and they also look similar. So the Dutch look a little bit like the British and look a little bit like the Germans, but if you keep moving far enough away, they'll start looking different,
mm-hmm.
and their language will be so different that you can't understand a thing. So they're, plus, you're thinking in the background, sort of intuiting, that the people that I'm related to live in my village and in the next village, mm-hmm. but they don't live three or four villages away. So I can identify people from my family in my village, in the next couple of villages, and then afterwards they become not so closely related. But they're close enough because I can still speak their language. And then I realize that after a while I keep walking, the language is a dialect. It's becoming more difficult to understand, but I can still understand it. And then it becomes eventually incomprehensible. So there is an association between linguistic relationship, kinship relationship, and geography. And that is articulated in the genealogies of the book of Genesis to try to place the Israelites in the world in relationship to everybody else. So the Adam and Eve story is this sort of primordial story that gets worked out in some detail in chapter 10 of Genesis, chapter 6, chapter 10, and a couple of other Genesis chapters. And you find they have political purpose as well. So, for example, when Lot has incestuous relationships with his daughters, or they have with him, it teaches us that the Ammonites and the Moabites are all bastards, and you better not intermarry with them. Don't get friendly with them. But they're related to you. And they speak your language, because the Moabites, remember, they're
mm-hmm.
speaking. We know that because we have this Neshas theory that
mm-hmm.
has basically Hebrew, a dialect of Hebrew. But you can't intermarry with them because they're also practicing a different religious tradition and they're a different kind of subgroup. And it's very tempting, because the people are like us and different enough to maybe be attractive or sexually attractive, but don't we need to retain our sense of identity in relation to the, all the other people around us. So these genealogies are fascinating, and they give a sense of place in the ancient Near East, and they tell you who you can be friends with and who you can't be friends with. And you can't be friends with virtually everybody. Even your close kin.
Don't talk to strangers.
Yeah.
Well, this sounds a bit like modern times when people change their names. I don't know. Just a guess. Feuerstein to Firestone.
Yeah.
You can still guess where it came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Guthermann to Goodman. Guthermann.
Guthermann to Goodman.
Goodman,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And Bamberg. Becomes smart bastard. And not just the Jews.
Friedman to Ben Chorin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so yes. So back to Arabia. In that economic situation, you have these agricultural oases that are producing more food than they need, and they sell to Bedouins, and they trade with Bedouins. And you have, but the population that is able to be sustained by these agricultural oases is relatively small. So there are all kinds of ways to keep the population down. So in the agricultural oases that can have a more dense population, you have a problem with natural expansion. You even have more of a problem in the desert areas, because the density that these desert areas can support human population is so small that they practice infanticide, and they also fight each other all the time. And there was constant warring between tribal communities. And that had a purpose, it had a kind of ecological purpose in that social economy, which was to keep the population down and also to make sure that only the really powerful, physically able people were able to survive the constant fighting. So they were tough people. This was the lean and mean production, producing lean and mean people. Have you ever seen a Bedouin that wasn't skinny? Arabs can be quite fat, but those are the ones who were sitting in the shops. Mm-hmm. The people who are with camels, you never see anyone who's not like thin, the men and the women, if you can see the women. The men, for sure, you see they're all very, like, they're like wiry. And
I've been drinking tea with the women.
Hmm?
I've been drinking tea with the women.
With the women,
they
so you get the advantage.
Yes,
that's
right, yes.
Yeah.
You can give us the insight.
And then they take off their veils.
So pre-Islamic Arabia is a martial culture, very similar to ancient Israelite culture, very martial.
What do you mean with martial?
Martial, militant, a militant culture. The Israelites fought everybody all the time. They were constantly having battles with themselves and with everybody else. And it was necessary to survive in a virtually even playing field, where the different tribes win some battles and they lose some battles, and it develops a kind of perspective that is one that expects that fighting and death is necessary for survival.
How does the Amalek story fit into this?
Hmm?
The Amalek story, sort of.
I don't know.
Attacking them on the way in.
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. That's a really enigmatic story. It doesn't. In the old Arabian tradition, there's a tribe of Amalek.
Oh, really?
Yeah, an Arabian tribe. It's an Arabian tribe in the biblical story too.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Arab genealogies, there are two views on it. There's one I think that is biblically influenced, and there's one that's not biblically. So the biblically influenced view has the Amalekites being bad people. But there are lots of other stories about the Amalekites who were just normal people. mm-hmm. a tribe. And even in Arabia, even in Mecca, mm-hmm. and that there were there are traditions that says that when Ishmael was Ishmael and Hagar were kicked out of by Abraham and mm-hmm. Sarah, they went to a place called Paran, mm-hmm. To Midbar Paran. And if you look at Midbar Paran in the Arab genealogies mm-hmm. or the Arab geographical dictionaries, it refers to Mecca. Mecca is Faran. And it says one of the old names for Mecca. Mm-hmm. So Faran, so Ishmael and Hagar settled in Mecca. And one of the tribes in the region that actually adopted them and took them in were the Amalekites. The Amalek, it's called in Arabic, Amalek, is in the plural.
And would that be something harking back to the blessing, if you can call it that, of Ishmael in verse 16 or something? He's going to live by his sword and so on.
Yeah, that's I think is a he is a pere Adam,
yeah.
right? Which we translate as a wild man. You can't trust him; he's out of control. But it really, a pere is a wild hamor. Hamor is a domesticated pere. A pere mm-hmm. is a wild donkey. Mm-hmm. So all that he is a wild person, meaning he is not a doesn't live in settlements. He lives in the desert.
He's not a Yosef O'Halim.
Yeah, he's not a Yosef O'Halim. And so that it's really interesting because the paradigm for Israelite life after the Exodus was to be agricultural, but before the Exodus it was steppe nomadism. That's what Abraham was. Mm-hmm. He went from place to place. Yeah. He was a mercenary. He was very happy to lie in order to get ahead, just like we accuse the Bedouins of doing. Mm-hmm. You can't trust them. You know, this was just, it was part of a tension between a nomadic lifestyle and an agricultural lifestyle. And so eventually the Israelites became agriculturalists, but it seems that there are traditions that suggest that they started out, at least at some level, as being pastoral nomads that made a transition. And so Ishmael becomes a paradigm of a community that doesn't make the transition. And Isaac, or even more so, Jacob, becomes the kind of primordial paradigm. And that makes sense, because Jacob is Israel, and Israel are agriculturalists.
Yeah, that's probably the ones who dig the wells. So.
Yeah. But even the, you know,
but
the
I'm not dug wells, Oliver.
But who did?
In many places, yes.
Yeah.
Well, Abraham.
Yeah.
Nomads dig wells. Mm-hmm. But so do agriculturalists. They all dig wells.
Right, we
should have seen that.
Yeah.
Just do what you
want
to be. So, back to Arabia. Mecca, which is the place where Ishmael and Hagar end up, according to the tradition. Mm-hmm. Remember that the angel brings forth water for Ishmael?
Right. At the end you talked about the Hajj, where they, the three hills.
Right. So that well is, in Islamic tradition, is the sacred well in Mecca. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Mecca is an uninhabitable area. Rocky, not good for nomads, not good for agriculture. Terrible weather, but there's this spring there, and there's this sacred spring, magic spring, which mm-hmm. brings a sense of sanctity to the area in a very unlikely place, and becomes a sacred area for the pre-Islamic Arabian community. So they come to this sacred spring at certain times of year to placate or to the powers that provide this living force in the middle of the desert. And eventually it becomes a sacred cult center where the various tribal communities would worship their own tribal gods. And so Mecca becomes a very important religious center in pre-Islamic Arabia for pre-Islamic Arabian polytheism. Okay? Medina, on the other hand, is an oasis. It's got a a very high water table. So the old water, they you know, if you do photography from the satellites, you see that there's like there's this big river in the middle of Arabia that isn't totally a desert, but it was the signs of old. Maybe when Arabia was, you know, somewhere else, you know, 1,000 kilometers in a different location as these tectonic plates were moving, but it still has retained that. And so there's a lot of water in Arabia, where there was a lot of water in Arabia, in aquifers. And in some places, the water is accessible. It rains virtually not at all, hardly at all, but there's still leftover water there. And in these areas, there would grow dates especially. That was the big crop. Dates were important for the camel nomads because they don't spoil. Right? And camels eat the stems and the seeds and the pits and all that. And they're happy. And so you, once you have a bunch of dates, you can go for a long time in the desert. And yeah, so that's Mecca, sacred site, and also the midway point between Saudi Arabia and Gaza.
Right? Medina.
No, Mecca. Mecca.
Oh.
So it becomes a very convenient stop for the spice transport business, the incense trade. Sort of like the Teamsters Union headquarters.
How far is it from Mecca to Medina?
200 miles.
Oh, so that's a trip.
Yeah,
that's
a trip.
Okay.
Sounds a bit like Jerusalem, which is not a very ideal place, and being on the route from Egypt to Mesopotamia, the area.
And it also has a magic spring.
Yes,
it's in the desert, in a very unlikely place. It's almost like on the top of the mountain. It has this huge amount of water comes out of the Shiloah.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Which still was outside of the city.
Yeah.
Had to bring it in.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that, I mean, it's quite likely that that's the source of the sanctity of Jerusalem.
Yes.
Remember, you know, nothing important happened there.
Ever.
Transcendent
no.
for the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not at all. But it immediately, as soon as David took it, it became a sacred place. Probably for political reasons, but they had, I'm sure that it had ancient sanctity that was associated with the spring, too, that the Israelites couldn't make a big deal out of because it would then take away from the notion of the transcendent
God. Except you have this pouring out of the water, and it's supposed to...
Yeah.
Right, well, and also the... isn't the whole messianic vision of water pouring forth from Jerusalem is all around, isn't it also around the same idea?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, water is redemptive.
Yeah,
sure.
Right.
But it's dangerous because you don't want to get too... You don't want to be too closely associated with the old notion of the water goddesses or the towers that turn the faucet on. Yeah.
Which is why the rain is emphasized as more or less.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm not sure anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
So, right, so back to... So now, all of this is kind of a pre... So the two sources of income, two sources of wealth for Mecca are the incense transport business and religious tourism. Because people would come during certain times of year to worship the gods in Mecca, or the representations of the gods in Mecca, and at that time they would also go to, they would trade with other tribes and other peoples, and they would go shopping, and they would, you know, go on, since they're in town, they'd go out and have a couple of nice meals in restaurants, and they'd go to the spa, and they would hire guides to tell them how to make the sacrifices at the various sacred places, and how to do it, and then they had to buy the sacrifices, so a lot of business was associated with this, just like in Jerusalem today, a lot of business associated with religious tourism. So where are we now? Let's see. So there's tension between tribes. Oh, tribes are in a state of perpetual war, right?
Mm-hmm.
and tribes have their own tribal legions that they're in control of, you're safe in that region. No overarching political system, no overarching legal system. The only way you know that you can protect yourself is to be with your kinfolk. The closest you are to your kin, the closest kin are trustworthy. The further away from the, you know, the close kin, the less trustworthy your own kin are. Right? And this is just a general view. So your, you know, nuclear family, extended family, clan, tribe, and then somebody who's outside the tribe.
Well, it's still that way in a lot of parts of the world.
Yeah, especially where there isn't good government.
Right.
And there's a debate in the
Western.
There's a debate in the academic community, and this is a big debate, and it's a very important one. And the question is it strong tribalism that doesn't allow government to ever actually become established? Or is it bad government that encourages development of tribalism?
Study Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Somalia.
Somalia, Afghanistan, northwest provinces in Pakistan, Arabia, the Arab world today. Mm-hmm.
But if you go, I mean, when we were at Sierra Leone, the Lebanese run almost all the businesses in Sierra Leone, but they only trust their families.
The Lebanese,
Yeah. And so they never expect, because you can't go any further than the bounds of your family. Mm-hmm. But you can't, you know, you don't get chains of things because you don't trust someone else to go do your business. So they have two or three stores, and, you know, it's this brother, and that's all. But it's
limiting, isn't it?
Oh, it's hugely limiting, right.
Yeah.
All right. But it's, I mean, it's, yeah, I don't know if it's that's the system, and so that's what they build on, because the government sucks.
Yeah, it's an important question. Because if it was one or not the other, mm-hmm. then you would have a different policy on how to try to create a system where people wouldn't be killing each other so often.
Mm. But if you look today at the differences between Libya and Tunisia, I learned about that Tunisia used to be a tribal society,
yeah.
but that completely dissolved.
Yeah. Right.
While in Libya, it's one of the problems now.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know why. I mean, I know more. I can't talk about that. Egypt has its own special situation, which is sort of trans-tribalism, because it has this old tradition of being an ancient civilization, and they have a kind of mythic view of all being Egyptians. Mm-hmm. And that's good for them. But I don't know why, and it doesn't solve all the problems. There are all kinds of, you know.
But there's still the south-north problems, though.
There's south-north problems. There's racial problems, too, dark and light.
Yeah.
They don't talk about it, but there is. And, you know, the people that are really the elegant people are almost all very light.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And
everywhere.
Yeah. And then you've got the religious issues, and you do have south and north, and you have dialectical issues, mm-hmm. and you have, you know, class stuff. So that, but I don't know why Tunisia ended up sort of jettisoning me. I know that Gaddafi played off on the tribal identities quite
right.
a bit,
right.
so he exacerbated any tendency to kind of get beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there was really good, or I know there wasn't good government in Tunisia, but maybe there was some, I don't know why Tunisia ended up the way it did. Anyway, and I don't know to what extent it has to do with Berber versus Arab ethnic differences, because there are differences in both of those communities.
If you look at Singapore, they had all these huge race riots and massacres. It's Malay, Chinese, and Indian. Mm-hmm. And they killed each other a lot, and the government invested enormously in building a national identity out of everybody, so they all think of themselves as Singaporean. And the government's been awful, but that's actually one of their huge successes, is they really did it. Unlike Malaysia, where they have the same mix of populations, mm-hmm. and the Chinese get massacred periodically all through. So maybe, I mean, I guess there's a function of government also that's sort of trying to forge some kind of overarching identity.
Yeah.
But what you talked about in the book also, that Islam didn't really succeed in doing that either. I mean, it tried, but...
Right, right. It was better, but it didn't, mm-hmm. they couldn't quite get over it. Couldn't get over the tribalism. Okay, so if you are in your tribal area that's controlled by your tribe, you're safe. If you go beyond the border, anybody could kill you. There's not there, and there's no crime killing another human being for moral, ethical reasons, or there's a political danger in killing someone of another tribe, and that is that you invite reprisal from the tribe because there is the vengeance system. Yeah. So if you, and there was nothing wrong, there was nothing inherently wrong with going into an area of another tribe and taking their flocks. Mm-hmm. So if you can get away with it. It was part of that building lean and mean, and if people die in the process, they weren't strong enough to be able to get by in that environment anyway, and so they get moved there out of the gene pool, you know, and you have this kind of system where people are really tough and violence is a part of life. So if you do make a raid into somebody else's area, you really try not to kill people. If you can avoid it, you do, because you're going to be inviting vengeance that will never end until they kill you, mm-hmm. the perpetrator, or they can't get the perpetrator to some close relative or mm-hmm. not so close relative.
But taking slaves?
Slavery wasn't... I don't think it was so necessary. There mm-hmm. were slaves, but it wasn't such a necessary thing because they didn't really need a lot of people. If you took a slave and it came into your family, then that would be absorbed into your tribe. Mm-hmm. Within sometimes a very short period of time, within a lifetime, mm-hmm. within the lifetime of the slave. So tribes, tribe and tribal kinship is all synthetic too. That's all is fluid. Everybody knows who belongs to who, but it really is all mythic.
This many horse has to eat.
Right.
So there you go. So the kinship tension and inherent competition and hostility between kinship groups actually works out quite well in the open desert, because you have enough area there so that you don't get lost, and so you know you're protected in your area. It's unlikely, and if you're near the border, you know that you're near the border. So if you want to make sure you're safe, or keep your family safe, or children safe, or women safe, you keep them away from the border. And it's a reasonably stable system. But that system of kinship relationship and tension and feuding and rivalry was an endemic cultural view throughout Arabia, whether you were living in the desert areas or whether you were living in the oases. So in oases, it was much more difficult to maintain because you were constantly bumping into people of other kinship groups. You'd have an oasis that would be primarily of one group. Mm-hmm. But remember that all this stuff is fluid, right? So you have one tribe, but within that tribe you have different clan groups. If the clan groups get large enough, they end up essentially being separate tribes. So they might be, they know, everyone knows they're related to one another, but they hate one another because they're a different clan. And one clan might get destroyed, and then the survivors of that clan become absorbed by the other clans. And so there's a kind of fluidity. New tribes are being created when a tribe gets too large and it sort of splits. And weak tribes become sort of destroyed and becomes reabsorbed into the more powerful tribes. And this is happening over periods of time. There was a famous study, and I always hesitate to cite this because they never found a source that I read once. It was a brilliant study about some British anthropologist or anthropology team that came into sub-Saharan Africa somewhere under British control in the very early part of the 20th century, and they did an ethnography, and they wanted to see who was related to who, and they found out that everybody in this whole region was related to one of four different clans, and the four clans derived from an eponymous ancestor who had four sons, and everybody was related to everybody else. Everybody knew exactly how they were related, and they could cite genealogies and relationships, and fine. So they published it, and they went home. And 70 years later, another group came back after independence and did the same ethnography. Mm-hmm. And it was exactly, this is the brilliant thing about this kind of oral cultural tradition where everybody remembers everything, and everyone knows everything, and you don't need writing because everyone remembers. So they did this ethnography, and they found exactly the same thing. The clans, they were all related to the same eponymous ancestor who had the sons, and everyone knew where they were, except there were only three tribes. And nobody knew anything about the fourth one. And it was 70 years later, and it was all sort of gone.
Did the names tally?
They all tied in somehow,
yeah.
But there was one, that one clan was missing. And it must have been absorbed by the others or was destroyed, and it was sort of blocked out of the memory. It was no longer contained in the oral tradition, and it fell out.
So did we have 12 tribes or not?
Yeah.
And we started off.
We were 13, yes.
Yeah.
And it also says something about the, you know, the noble savage, that so-called, right, who remembers everything,
yes,
in the oral tradition. And of course we remember. And, you know, there were studies of Homer. Do you know about this
the
question? About the Homeric, great Homeric epic.
Yeah. 7 centuries.
Well, yeah. It was, so
we possibly recontextualize our own.
Exactly.
Story.
You keep telling it. Every time you tell it, you tell it differently.
Yeah.
But the time
you to.
Yes. Right.
That's George. Mm-hmm. George Steiner with his remembrancers.
Yeah. Well, so now we know something about pre-Islamic Arabia. Mm-hmm. Muhammad was born into a tribe called the Quraysh tribe. From the word Karish. You know what a Karish is in modern Hebrew? Well, Karish is a shark.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So Quraysh means a little shark. I have no idea why. Quraysh. And that tribe was the tribe that was in control of Mecca. So Mecca was a single tribal community, but they had clans that were, you know, in competition with one another, rival clans within. Muhammad was born to a clan called the Banu Hashim, Hashemites. And sometimes it's spelled H-A-S-H-E-M, which throws everyone off because they think it means Hashem. Mm-hmm. I come from the Hashem clan. But it's Hashem, is the guy's name. And his mother died, his father died before he was born. His mother died when he was 2, and he grew up as an orphan. He was living, you know, below the safety net in Mecca. Now, when something like that occurred in the tribal life in the deserts, the child would immediately be adopted and absorbed into a community. There was some great advantage about the nomadic communities in that no one could accumulate wealth because you're traveling all the time. Mm-hmm. Wealth really meant
heavy stuff.
Camels, goats, donkeys. And you can't even have too many of them because they will eat you out of house and home. You have to give them away if you have too much. So a wealthy person would gain status by giving away his wealth to other people in the clan. It's not just giving away, you get something for it, which is high status, and you become an important person, and you're consulted, and you're powerful. So if you went on raids and gained goods, you would distribute them. There's a famous statement in the Lawrence of Arabia movie, if you've seen this. I don't know if you recall, Lawrence, have you seen the movie Lawrence?
No, I don't think I've ever seen it. It is
a fantastic movie for Arab culture in general. Mm-hmm. There's some very important pieces. There's one where, there's one scene where the guy who plays Zorba the Greek too, what's his name? Anthony Quinn. Mm-hmm. He's playing this Arab sheik and he's really good. And he says, I am a river to my people. He gets gold. He gets paid off by the Ottomans, and he won't attack them. And he gets all this money, and he says, "I am a river to my people. The gold comes to me, and it goes out to my people." Because he can't. He's a veteran. He can't even carry it around with him. So it goes out to everybody. It turns out that he didn't really get into it. He gave out 50,000 gold, whatever he would get, but he actually received 100,000. Right? So he was hoarding, and Lawrence knew that, so he was calling him on his bluff. But in any case, That's the tradition, is you're a river to your people. But when you live in an urban environment, and you're living in a house and you're not traveling, you can hoard wealth. And there can be, there necessarily becomes a kind of distinction, class distinctions between people in villages that you don't have when you're equals out in the steppe. And so there are poor people and there are wealthy people in Mecca. And they're not poor people and wealthy people in the same tribe or communities that live out in the desert. So Muhammad was a poor person, and he was, and he suffered. And that's part of his background. He is too poor to even marry until he becomes basically an old man of 25. Only my kids were married by 25. You'd be happy. Then, and he married, he couldn't marry someone who was some young thing. Mm-hmm. He married a widow who was 15 years older than him, named Khadija. And she had been married to a man who was involved in the trading business. And so she had money. So he married into some wealth. He was suddenly married up into the middle class, and he was taken care of, and they apparently loved one another quite a bit. And he then began to engage in kind of meditation practices, and he was disturbed by the inequity in Mecca, and there wasn't anything he could do about it. And one of his meditative states, he was visited by an angel, Gabriel, who gave him the first revelation of the Quran. I think that's probably in the book. Mm-hmm. And he believed that he was possessed, because he was by himself, and there are genies out in the desert. Mm-hmm. And he received this kind of vision, audio vision, that was implanted in him in a poetry, which was a typical way in which people were possessed by genies. And the great poets of the ancient pre-Islamic period were often possessed. They were often crazy people. And he thought that that had happened to him. You know, in modern Hebrew, I don't know how much you know about really modern Hebrew, but in modern Hebrew, one of the ways to say Meshigana, mm-hmm, is to say Majnun. Have you heard the term Majnun? Majnun, ma'ata Majnun. Yeah, especially Sephardi Jews, you know, mm-hmm, Mizrahi Jews. Because Majnun means possessed by a jinn. Majnun. Mm-hmm. Right? Like Januni. Mm-hmm. Right? And so that's what it means in Arabic. To say Majnun means you're possessed by a jinn. Yeah. So he thought he was possessed by a jinn, and he runs home to his wife Khadija, and while he's, you know, wrapped up in a blanket and he thinks it's all over, he gets his second revelation that says, "Hey, you wrapped up in a blanket, get up and respond to your God." And he begins to realize that he's not possessed, and that he's actually receiving revelations from God. And he begins to realize that he is a prophet and an emissary of God, and he needs to respond to the divine call to go out to preach to the people of Mecca and tell them to live the life that they have been missing, which is a life of ethics and care for the poor and the indigent, and to worship one God who is a righteous, compassionate, but just God, who won't allow you to do unethical things, and insist that you worship one God and not the, you know, the idols who are kind of frivolous and are not ethical. So it was a kind of an ethical, really strong ethical monotheism, is with these early revelations of the Quran. Economic equity, justice, fairness, and monotheism. And that the world is going to come to an end soon. And so you better get your act together before it ends. By the way, it never happened.
Yesterday.
Didn't happen, did it? What a disappointment. I would like to see the newspapers, see what's on.
I just saw something last night about the Mayan prophecies for December 21st, 2012.
Now we can...
Their calendar ends, so we have another year and a half. We have a reprieve.
If you make a break between sessions, I can stop this thing and start it again, just to get tracks that are
this one, yes. Okay. Are we going to take a break?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay.